transported back to the little bitty North Lake Church of Christ. Sits just outside of Dallas. This little white frame building, wooden chairs, you know, those little wooden pews, individual ones that creaked when he, every time he got up and sat down, you know, and we would sing that song, all 25 of us. And Violet Perlwitz was her name. She sat right up here at the front, and she was the lead soprano, and she would belt that song out like you wouldn't believe. I would lead that song every now and then. I was 7, 8, 9 years old, and I'd stand up. My mom would say, "Don't worry about it. All you gotta do is hit that first note, and Vi will take it away from you." She would, man. She would hit the ground running. But what other song did we get to sing that talked about dragons? I mean, that's an awesome song. I just remember singing that song over and over in that little bitty church. But the same church building, it had a single aisle right down the middle. We sat back here, kind of where the Harrises are sitting all the time. That's where we always sat. In the same church building where my stepdad one time sneezed so hard into the center aisle that he sneezed his teeth out. Literally lost his dentures in the aisle. And he scooped down and picked them up and put them right back in. I laughed and laughed. I laughed so hard, my mom sent me out of church. She said, "You got to go outside until you stop laughing." Funniest thing was, I didn't know he had false teeth. So when his whole teeth came out, you know, that was the first time. I what in the world? I'd never known anybody sneeze that hard before. But good old North Lake Church of Christ. It was a fun place. We had a good time. That was my upbringing way back when. You know, we used to go to church all the time, and one time I got up early in the morning and I was in trouble. I was late. I know that's a shocker to some of you. But I was late getting up that morning, thought I had more time than I did. My mom was yelling and screaming at me, and she said, "We are leaving." Slammed the door, started the car. I came running out, and the driveway was empty. And I thought, I'm in trouble now. It's going to be a problem. So I didn't know what to do. I sat there at the house for about 20 minutes trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was about, 14, 15 years old. I decided to walk to church that morning. And we lived about a mile and a half from church, across a couple of highways and whatever, and I decided I was going to walk to church. And the whole way that I walked to church, man, I was in my suit tie, I had my coat and tie, I'm walking to church, you know, hoping nobody would stop me and ask to take me or whatever. Anyway, I got there, and I got in. Mom's like, "Are you okay?" "Oh, yeah, I'm fine. And I sat down, and that was one day that I avoided the spanking. Because I did get spankings even at 14 years old. I got a couple of pops across the backside when I was really, really in trouble. But that church, I was like, okay, as long as I get to church, I will be okay, right? I'm going to be in trouble, but if I could just make it to the building, then everything would be okay. And actually that day, it was. My mom was like, "I can't believe you walked all the way here." She went, you know, that was back in the 70s or the early 80s. It wasn't real dangerous to walk like that. But all I knew was I had to get to church, because if I was at church, everything would be okay. You know, as for a 14-year-old, that's not a bad thought, right? You know, get them to church, get them here, everything's going to be okay. But as an adult, I struggle with that idea, that little lie inside of my head that says, you know what? You're okay. If you just go here, if you just go there, if you just make it to church, you'll be okay. And it's not just church, but it's all kinds of things. We have a thing in American culture. We greet each other with this insincere greeting of, "Hi, how are you?" Right? "How are you?" And we say, "I'm..." Oh, come on, you know this one. "How are you?" "I'm fine." Yeah, oh yeah, well, see, if you're fantastic, that's different, right? Fantastic is great. But most of the time we're just like, "I'm fine." And the reality is, rarely are we fine. I've told you the story before. In Germany, I stopped this lady on the front doorstep as we were going to the church building. Germans do not have the same greeting. How are you? They don't say, how are you? They say, good day, good day, good day. They don't say, how are you? And so in German, my broken German, I'm still learning the culture. And so in German, I say, wie geht's, which means, how are you, is my greeting, right? And this 81-year-old woman, Ursula, she opens the front door. I'm holding the front door, and I say, Ursula, wie geht's? And I shake, put my hand out, because you're supposed to shake hands. And she's shaking my hand. I told Travis the story this week. I'm shaking her hand. She's shaking my hand. I said, wie geht's? And she, like a true German, is blatantly honest with me, right? I asked a question. How are you? She's going to answer the question. And she says, oh, David, ich bin schlecht, which means I'm bad. And I thought, oh, Ursula, doesn't stop, doesn't skip a beat. She goes, I had diarrhea all night last night. Now, mind you, I'm shaking her hand. And I was like, and then she continues to tell me her problems. And for the next 30 seconds, I get a whole medical rundown of what's happened over the past 24 hours. I really didn't want to know that, right? I was just making conversation. The truth of the matter is, the more we tell people I'm fine, I'm good, everything's good, because of who I am or where I live or what I do or what I make sure I'm going to be a part of, I'm good, everything is good. And slowly but surely, we tend to buy into that deception until we start believing it ourselves. And we start thinking, you know what? Because of who I am something special. I'm fine. I don't need anything else. I'm doing, you know, I've been where I need to be. I do what I need to do. I am fine. And the reality is, we all know, if we peel the onion back far enough, we got rotten stuff underneath us. And I don't say that to depress you this morning. I don't tell you that because I want to bring you down and think, oh, you know, we're all just broken. But the fact is, we are all broken. And God gives us a family to lift us up. Hopefully you spent some time this week, maybe most of you spent a little bit of the time this week, Thanksgiving celebration, right? I know there's always the crazy uncle someone there. I'm not going to fill the blank that name that you're like, I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to be there. But for most of us, we spend lots of time with family, right? Encouraging one another, building one another up. Yeah, we jab each other a little bit, but the idea is family is where you can be real and honest. Family is where you can be who you really are and not have to continue with the facade that I'm fine when underneath I'm not. We've been working in our junior high school class for the past few weeks. We've been talking about pure in heart. Blessed are those who are pure in heart. We've talked about how do you become pure in heart, because we're not pure in heart. We've all seen too many things. We've all done too many things. We've all been a part of things that we should not have been a part of. It's human nature. So how do we cleanse and become clean? And that becomes a struggle. Because deep down inside, the only way we get rid of what we've got is to get rid of what we've got. It's to offer it up. And typically that takes along the lines of sharing or working through those problems with someone else. And what better place to do it than the family of God? A God who calls us together, a God who calls us to be one with him. Okay, so I say all this because today we're going to continue in the book of John. I've been doing a series of John. We've been working through John, through chapter, kind of chapter by chapter. And we're going to pick up the next part of our story in John. And we're going to just hit a highlight because it's getting to the point where there's more chapters than we have time left. So we're going to just hit some high points and go through it. But we're working through John because our leadership training for Christ group, our high school and junior high kids, are learning the book of John, are preparing with the book of John to go and do their speeches and to do their Bible Bowl competitions and their puppets and all those kinds of things. That's coming up. And so right now what we're doing is we're kind of working through the book of John. And so today's the next installment of that. So if you'll take your Bibles and open up, we're going to look at the book of John in chapter 8. And I will have to put my glasses on here because I'm just getting older and older. Thanksgiving just made it 1 year older here. But we're going to talk about the book of John in chapter 8. We're not going to talk about the woman caught in adultery. That's the first chapter. We're going to skip on down a little bit, or first half of that chapter. We're going to skip on down and pick up the story a little bit later. But let me tell you what's going on here, right? Jesus has been teaching. Jesus has been teaching in the temple. He's in Jerusalem. He's had some people that have been a little angry with him, to say it mildly, right? He's been stirring the pot a little bit, and people are starting to get a little upset. In fact, the leaders of the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, in fact, dispatched a group of soldiers to go capture him, to arrest him and bring him in, because ultimately what they want to do is to kill him, right? Squelch him, get rid of the messenger, so we don't have to deal with the message. And so that's what we find in John chapter 6 and 7. And now we're moving into chapter 8. And he's going to confront some of these people that he's preaching to, or they've been listening to him preach and teach in the temple courts. It's a little crazy because the arguments start to kind of pile on top of each other. And we kind of really have to have a clear head as we approach it. So it's hard to do this quickly. Now we're going to zoom in on just a little bit of this passage, but I would encourage you to go back and read the entire chapter of chapter 8. Because it starts off, as I said, with this woman caught in adultery. And if you remember, she has the accusers, they're ready to stone her to death because she was caught in the act of adultery. And remember, Jesus writes down in the dirt, and eventually the accusers all file away, and the woman says, he says, "Where's your accusers?" And she says, "They're all gone." He said, "Is no one left to condemn you?" And she says, "No, sir." He says, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." He starts with this near stoning at the first part of the chapter. And he works his way through the chapter to the end of chapter 8, where at the very bottom, the last verse of chapter 8, we find out that the Jews are ready to stone Jesus. So a possible stoning of this woman and ending up with a near stoning of Jesus himself. And in the midst, in the middle of all this, we get some teaching of these people, of the Jews here, the leaders of the Jews, that he's been talking to. So we're going to pick up the story here in the middle of chapter 8. I want to remind you a couple quick things. John is basically a second generation book, right? It's not one of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all written together, kind of synced with each other, kind of telling the same stories and the same chronology. But John is different, kind of a maverick. He's a little bit different of writer, different perspective. In fact, he's writing to a different audience. He's probably writing to an audience that is a second generation of Christians. People who are not necessarily first-time believers, but are people who are trying to hold on to their faith. And this word faith is going to figure in very prominently throughout the book of John. Interestingly enough, John never uses the word faith as a noun. He never uses this Greek word that we translate into faith as a noun. And so it's often translated in his Bible, in his book, as believe. Because in English, we don't have the word faith in verb form. My father and I were talking about this over at Thanksgiving. He was reminding me of a book that was written by Randy Harris, professor over at ACU. Great book on the book of John. And one of the points that Randy makes is this point that John never uses the noun form of faith. It's always used in action, but we don't have an action verb form of faith. We don't say, "I'm going to faith something. I am faithing today." And so we translate that believe, but believe tends to fall short of what John is talking about when he mentions having faith in God, believing in God. It's more than belief. It's faith that something's going to happen, that something's going to be done, that you're going to be protected and taken care of. It's more than just the word belief, which is another point too. Because words are never as important as actions, right? Actions speak louder than words. Is that right? I mean, do you find that true in your experience? Actions speak louder than words. I can tell Bobby that I'm going to be on time, and that's what I hear until I show up. And every now and then, he's like, "What are you doing here so early?" I'm like, doesn't happen often, but it does happen every now and then. Those are not just words. Actions speak louder than words. And I really struggle with this. Maybe you do too. With the idea that I say what I want, but am I really doing what my words are saying? I can tell you I want to accomplish this, but do my actions follow up on my words? Folks, far too often, I admit, I fall greatly short of that. And therein wrapped up is integrity. Are you doing what you say you're going to do? And more importantly, do your actions confirm what your mouth has already said? Does the preacher practice what he preaches? Do parents tell their kids what to do or show them what to do? How many times have you heard that? Don't do as I do as I say. Well, but Dad, you know, Do we as Christians show the love, do the love, faith the love that God calls us to be recognized by? Or do we merely profess it with our mouths? Do we just show up at church so that we'll be okay? Or are we doing the things that Christ has called us to do because we believe in Him? It's not good enough to say it. Faith is an action. It's one of the reasons why we place so much emphasis on baptism. Because it's one thing to believe in God, but it's quite another to put Him on in baptism. To accept that gift freely and receive the forgiveness that we believe comes with it. Okay, so let's look in John chapter 8. John chapter 8, starting down in verse 31. Then Jesus said to the Jews who believed Him. Now look, He's talking to the Jews who are believing Him. Now, some versions say Judeans. Some versions translate this just general Jews. What most of the Bible scholars will agree on to some extent is that who He's talking to is not all of the Jews. He's not talking to everyone, but He's talking to a specific group of people who believe Him, but maybe have not acted on that faith yet. Who've believing the claim that He is the Messiah, as we've read in the passages previously, but are not doing anything based on that, are not truly acting on that belief. Because faith is not just belief, faith with actions. Without actions, it's dead, right? That's what Hebrews tells us. Then Jesus said to those Jews who believed Him, if you abide in My word, or one version says, if you remain or continue to follow in My teaching, you are My disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. This word abide is real interesting here. This word that's translated abide in some versions, if you abide or remain in My word, you are My disciples indeed. That word can be translated, it has a lot of different ideas with it, remain, stay, continue. But there's also a concept of living wrapped up in that. That's where we get the word the abode, my abode, where do you live? I abide somewhere, I have my abode, my home, to make your home somewhere. The act of living out your life is wrapped up in this word abide. So what He's saying is if you live out My word, if you live in My word, you are My disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. The word, My word, He's talking here, this logos, what we started out, we know from the very beginning, John chapter 1, the word became flesh. The logos took on humanity, fully God and fully human. And if you abide in My word, if you abide in Me, sometimes He will say, you are indeed My disciples. Abide is used dozens and dozens of times throughout the book of John. And it has this idea of continual living, day after day after day. That is what we do in the Word. The result of doing that is the very next sentence that he has that we just read. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. What truth, Jesus? What truth is it that we're trying to know? What is it that is true? Well, John tells us multiple times throughout his book, starting in the very first chapter and working almost toward the end, there is only one truth, and it's Jesus. Jesus is the truth. Well, now, wait a second, Jesus. How can a person be the truth? How can a person be true? Well, again, there's more to the word truth than a lot of times what we think. I mean, when I think of truth, I think of, you know, someone under interrogation. Are you going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Are you going to get the truth serum so what they say is going to be the true? He says, I am truth. From beginning to end. What I am is true, loyal, here's that word again, faithful, honest, transparent, the real deal. I am truth. And the words I bring are true. Because I am true, you can count on the words that I say as being true. And if you remain in those things and my teaching, you will know those things too. You will know me. And I, he says, the truth will set you free. Then this is very interesting, because this is where the Jews come up against this idea that we're okay. We're not quite sure why we need your truth. We fooled ourselves into believing that we are okay. We pick it up in verse 33. And they answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants, and we have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Now the Jews took the freedom as a word for slavery, as an idea of slavery, okay? If you are not free, you must be enslaved in something. And the Jews, these Jews apparently, they said, "Wait a minute, we're Abraham's descendants. We've never been in bondage to anyone." Now, what? What? I wanted to see Jesus. I'd love to see Jesus' face go, huh? What? Right? Because was it not Egypt that enslaved you for 400 years? Were you not slaves in Babylon? Are you not now somewhat slaves under Roman rule as Jesus is standing in the temple? Interestingly enough, as he's standing in the temple courts, right? Standing in the temple courts, looking east, the temple is facing east. If he's standing in front of the temple, talking to these Judeans, talking to these people around here, all he would have to do is to look this direction, and at the far east, north, south, east, and west. So north, go north, and you look over this northwest corner, there is a large citadel, a large kind of castle with four turrets that are built. And the turrets are so tall, they sit right next to the Temple Mount, right next to the temple itself. But they built those turrets so tall that the Roman garrison can stand on those turrets and simply look out the windows or look off the roof and look over the entire court of the temple of God. The Jews say, "We've never been in bondage." All Jesus would have to do would go, "Who's looking over you right now? There are soldiers who are keeping you under control as we speak. You guys have believed a lie." And that's what Jesus is going to point out to them. He says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits a sin is a slave of sin." Whoa, Jesus, hang on just a second. Wait, we thought you were talking about like physical slavery. We thought you were talking about putting us in chains. Jesus, just like Jesus does, takes a tangent, what seems like a tangent, but it's really what he's doing is cutting directly to the core. Right? He's getting through all the garbage. He's going straight to the core message, straight to the core problem. When he says, "Most assuredly, I say, your slavery is a slavery of sin." Whatever happened with the Egyptians, whatever happened with the Babylonians, whatever's now going on in Rome, Your slavery is not to men. It's not a social slavery. It's not an economic slavery. It's a slavery of the spirit. It's a slavery of the heart. You're slaves to sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the son makes you free, you will be free indeed. You know, this is our problem today too. Because we can say as Americans, we are free. We are free. We enjoy the freedoms of a country that were bought by blood shed on foreign fields. We talked about Veterans Day not too long ago and celebrated those men and women who have given sacrifices so that we can live in a country that we do. And there's nothing to diminish that. But sometimes we start believing the lie that because we are free politically, because we are free economically, because we are free socially, we are free indeed. And Jesus says, you're blinded. You've convinced yourself that freedom is something about where you can eat or where you can live or how you can speak. And yet you're racked with slavery. You're in bondage so deep you don't even know it. The problem today is that's not a popular thing to say. We don't like to talk about sin much in the world today because we assume sin means a couple of specific things that we like to target or like to be targeted in the media and things, sexual sin and other kinds of things, and that's it. But sin is so much more. It's rebellion against God. It's rebellion about all that He has planned for us. It's rebellion about everything that He wants to do in our lives, and it's me saying, I can do it myself. It's me saying, I'm okay because of me. Are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. I've got this. I've got this. And Jesus looks at us like He looks at those people in that temple courtyard and says, you're enslaved to sin. They'll go on to argue. You can read down through the rest of the passage. They'll go on to argue that, look, Abraham is our father. And Jesus says, look, if Abraham was your father, you would do the things that Abraham did. Abraham had faith in God. He trusted the message. I am from God. You don't believe me, so you can't be from Abraham. In fact, his biggest charge was not even non-belief. His biggest charge was, you want to kill me. You've planned and plotted to kill me. And a murderer would not be one of Abraham's sons, would not be from the lineage of Abraham. If you were doing what Abraham, it's not killing one of God or anyone for that matter. And they said, no, we're God's. God is our father. And He says, no, because God, it's one of the commandments, do not murder. And here you are contemplating murder. You're not from God. You're following someone else. And He calls him out, says, you're following the devil. That force of evil in our world that opposes God and everything good. And how does that work in our lives? It works the same way from the very beginning. It wasn't a horrific thing that happened in the garden. It was a simple little lie that turned into tragedy. And it starts with a little half-truth, a little more of a lie, a desire to be more like God. Me to be God. Not to live like God, but to be God. And to grasp it for myself. You see, throughout this entire book here, John is trying to tell us one thing. He's trying to tell us this is Jesus. This is God's Son come to earth to be the Messiah, to save you and set you free from the bondage of sin. Now, Jesus doesn't go into explanation right here about how that's all going to work. He doesn't explain how his death on the cross is eventually going to set people free. He doesn't tell all those kinds of things, but he sets the seed here and says, if you were from God, you would listen to me. You would throw off the lie that everything is fine, and you would do the things that I am teaching. You wouldn't just say you believe, but you would do your belief. You wouldn't just have faith, but you would faith. And how do we do that, Jesus? What is it, abiding, living your word? How does that really look in my life? What does it mean to live out your word? Well, John's going to tell us later on in one of his other books, you will know my people by the love they have for each other. You will know them by their love, their care for one another, and their love for me. Jesus is asked, what are the two greatest commandments? The first one is love God with all your heart, your soul, and all your mind and strength. And the second is like this, love your neighbor as yourself. Within these, all of the commandments hang. He says it's simple. Abiding in me is caring for one another. Abiding in me is learning my word, living in my word every day by caring and loving each other. It's not enough for me to walk to church just so I can be there and I'm okay. It's for me to be here and love one another and to be loved. Sometimes that's more difficult than the other way around. To love and to be open to being loved. It's no accident that John becomes a master, the love disciple, the one who writes his entire collection of books, his letters, centering around the idea of love. He was the disciple that Jesus loved. Did Jesus love them all? Yes, absolutely. But for some reason, John picked up and his message, not to those very first Christians, but to maybe that second generation. You want to hang strong? You want to keep in the faith? You want to keep on till the reward is given? Love one another. My dear children, he says, love one another. And that's our call today. If there's any way that we can love on you, if there's anything that we can do to reach out to you, if there's any way that we can lift you up, if there's anything that you can do to lift us up, because we are in need as much as you are, we're all in this together. Actions speak much louder than words. The invitation is always open. You're welcome to come now as we stand and sing.